Today's guest got to combine her passions in a single work. The passions are writing and concern for the people of Darfur. Kimberly Carlson lives in Reading. She's the author of Out of the Shadows. The principal character shares Kimberly's concerns for the Darfuri people. We'll spend the hour talking about life in the real world for Kimberly and in the world she created for her character, Jamie Shire. Kimberly Carlson got her MA in English Composition and Literature from Humboldt State. She taught composition and creative writing at Shasta College and has worked with several groups to end the genocide in Darfur in Sudan. She started First Snow Publishing and published Out of the Shadows in 2012 and won an independent publishing award in 2013. Kimberly Carlson, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You write so passionately on your website about writing. Can we assume you've done this for a long time?
Yes, writing and art is my passion. I've been writing for about 25 years. My belief system with art and writing is that it can change our lives in positive ways. It can make us become more in depth, more passionate. We could see ourselves more clearly and other people more clearly.
What kind of art?
Well, writing's my art, mm-hmm. but I appreciate all art forms. My next book, actually, my protagonist is an artist. So I just, other than writing Darfur, art is my other passion.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we'll talk about the next work before we talk about the current work. Who are the people would you say have inspired you the most as a writer?
Kate Chopin. I'm actually rereading Edith Wharton. I've always loved Toni Morrison, contemporary writer. Janet Finch is one of my favorite contemporary writers. But I also do love the classics as well. Virginia Woolf, I think when I read her work, I read it like in sentences because each sentence makes me think and ponder.
Which is high praise for any writer, that each individual sentence has that much power to move.
Right, exactly.
Edith Wharton seems to pop up a lot in discussions that you have and that people have about your work. Is there any particular aspect of her writing that you most wanted to emulate or that you most admire?
You know, I like I said, I'm rereading The Age of Innocence, and I don't, my novel is nothing like The Age of Innocence. And
The Age of Debauchery, right?
Yeah. I felt, I think because she and like Kate Chopin and some of those early, those were the people who inspired me early on in life. And so I don't feel like my work is like hers. I just feel like it was the passion for living in life that fed my passion for living in life and through writing.
You include a Kafka quote on your website that what you're reading should wake you up with a blow to the head. Are you part of the blow to head school of writers?
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, a book should entertain as well. But for me, when I'm writing, I go to the heart of my matters and the matters are in my characters. And so, yeah, the Kafka, it should be like the axe within us. And so, and for all my books, and those are the kind of books that I'm attracted to that make me think and maybe reevaluate and I learn something.
But the kind of passion you're talking about can be a fairly sustained one as well. I mean, not just a short, sharp shock, but something that lasts for a while, I think is what you're saying too.
Right. I guess people could define passion differently. But yeah, passion for me would be something like a steel rod in my spine. It's not going to go away.
So not necessarily raging characters and that sort of thing going on
right.
in your work.
Yeah, no, if you talk about the Darfur, I would have never have guessed that 10 years later I would still be talking about Darfur.
Have there been other causes you have embraced and sort of moved away from over time?
I mean, no.
Really, Darfur was it?
It was the first, and that's why, like my character, I did my undergraduate at Belmont, which was... It's a Southern Baptist university, and so it had its causes. And then I did my graduate work at Humboldt, who was also very had its causes. And I never was, I just did my studies, hung out with my friends, and so so this was the first cause that I took up. And I'm slightly ashamed of that, but yes.
All right, so something you really got a chance to latch onto. And what about, how, do you remember when it first came to your attention, the fate of the people in Darfur?
Yes, I was pregnant with my son at the time, and he just turned 9. And I just watched Hotel Rwanda, about the genocide in Rwanda. And I was so shocked about that I didn't know anything about that genocide. And the fact that I was a college student while that genocide was taking place, I thought, you know, college students are people who have the time and energy to address such things. And so I started studying it, and I learned that there was a genocide going on that moment. And I was teaching at Shasta College at the time, and I thought, and I was pregnant, and I thought, I have to do what I can now, because once my son is born, I'll just focus on him. And so I taught, you know, I would bring things in to my students. I'd have them write to then President W. Bush. And I had my friends and family over, and we had a pizza party, and we learned about where Darfur was and what was happening. And then I was going to be done. And what happened when my son Elias was born, I felt a greater cause to help the moms and dads and children that were being slaughtered and sent from their homes.
It's a long, sorrowful tale, and it continues in portions up to today as well. But the efforts do continue, I notice, from the group you're affiliated with in Reading.
Yes. Yes, Darfur still really needs our attention and our concern.
All right, we'll talk much more about that when we come back from a break. Out of the Shadows is a novel by Kimberly Carlson, who lives in Reading. Its character, like Kimberly, also has a concern about the people in Darfur. We'll come back and talk about the book, the work, life in both worlds, and much more when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the Reading resident and novelist Kimberly Carlson. Her book Out of the Shadows came out in 2012, won an independent publishing award in 2013, and still stands up today because there are still concerns about the people of Darfur, which is a concern that Kimberly shares with the protagonist of her book, Jamie Shire. We'll talk about Darfur, we'll talk about writing, we'll talk about a whole lot more with Kimberly in this hour. And you can join us at 800-838-3760 around the region, 800-838-3760, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. One Amazon review I read of Out of the Shadows says the book is good for people who like the kind of fiction that will challenge. Another says a little like psychotherapy. What's it like to read the reviews of your work, and particularly when people are either heaping praise or scorn on it?
Right. I was in a philosophy class once in Humboldt, and there was a brilliant young man who I admired, and he would seldom smile from when people would comment on his brilliant statements. And the idea was, he can't take to heart if he doesn't take the criticism. So, you know, every writer, I'm assuming today, looks at Amazon and Goodreads and reads their review. But I always do it at a moment when I can then also read if something was written negatively about my work. But of course, it's always, you know, being a writer, there's so many lonely moments, and the praise is so little. Everything about it is, you know, you have to find this inner strength to keep going. So anytime I hear something positive about my work, it does give me strength to keep going.
Interesting to think about in terms of lonely moments, but I've had this discussion with other writers as well. I mean, they have to spend a lot of time off by themselves with their computer tapping away. And I mean, do you feel sometimes like you've been put in a timeout, or is it something that just feels so good when you're doing it, you don't really notice?
Well, I love time alone, and I have a 6-year-old and a 9-year-old. So those moments are usually while they're sleeping in the morning. But I think I, you know, it's always really hard to start writing. And that's why discipline is so important. And but once I get going, I love it. But this novel took me 7 years to finish, and I think 'cause it had so much research in it. But you have to love to be alone to be a writer. I really think that, because it takes, you know, just you and your computer for hours and hours and hours.
So to the details of the book, Jamie Shire, the main character in Out of the Shadows, who is she and how did you construct her?
Yes, Jamie Shire. As I said, I began the book when I was pregnant, and it wasn't my first manuscript. And I was, everyone always says, oh, having a child will change your world. And I thought, oh my gosh, I have to start a new book before the baby's born. Otherwise, I don't know what's going to happen to me. And so I wanted to create a character with all this potential of smarts and intuition and talent, and yet she had never been told these things about herself. Her worth was really low. And so how would a young woman, she's in her 20s, and she already feels like she missed the college age, how does a young woman really come into herself and feel her strength and feel her wisdom and be able to come what she feels she can? And the way that my character does it is by stepping out of herself and looking at other people's pain and suffering, and also hearing other people's stories and really taking those stories in. And through that, and through mentors along the way, she starts to say, I can.
So Jamie is jobless, broke, and living on a friend's couch when she meets Akasha in a coffee shop who offers her work. Only on the drive home do we learn that Jamie is also nursing a broken heart. What kind of discipline does it take as a writer to hold back on details like that, like not say right up front, you know, Jamie, you know, is also coming back from a failed relationship or that kind of stuff, and not to barf out all the details at once?
Well, there was 100 pages before I actually started the book. So, I mean, just editing, mostly that would come through editing. So the first 100 pages were edited out.
Wow.
And then I did, of course, put some of those details in as the story unfolds.
So in those 100 pages that were discarded, did we get to see Jamie's decline into arriving on the friend's couch?
Yes, you get to see it more clearly. But I just felt that I wanted to get to the mansion sooner, and the mansion is where she starts to heal, and then we get more of her, how she ended up there as backstory.
All right, so tell us about Fallow Springs Estate and where in your mind this came from.
Okay, Fallow Springs Estate. We mentioned Wharton, but also Chopin. But my mom's from Tennessee, and I went to school in the South, and I have always loved Gothic literature, and from Faulkner to Tennessee Williams. And so I wanted to create a really mysterious mansion that had that she felt was actually alive, and the characters in it, the people in it, were all mysterious to her. But and that's was played with, that she's unraveling herself as she's trying to unravel their stories. And so and that was my goal of Fallow Springs.
Well, and in Fallow Springs, Jamie has her interview with Akasha, which is unusual in a number of respects, just in setting and the way people dress and that sort of thing. But then Jamie has an interesting reaction to the interview herself.
Yes. I mean, she, I think it was too much for her. And she, and Akasha does intrigue her, but also scares her. And I think for me, I think it was that moment that we're faced with always a chance to say yes or no on a new road, a new way of being. And at first she was scared and she reacted to that fear, but then she ended up taking the challenge on and moved into the mansion. And it was in the mansion that Akasha, it pays her to do her philanthropic work. And this was a totally new area for Jamie, and she was at a loss of what to do.
And actually barfs in the job interview. I love the little details in here, though, like the servant who's supposed to be the one who cleans up Jamie's barf. I mean, do you start with a roster of characters and then add or subtract as needed, or pretty much stick with what you started with?
The characters in the mansion, I did start with those, and what I think happened, and I will say, I mean, being the writer, I still love the characters in that book. And I think they become more dimensional as you write. And each of those characters became more dimensional. And then when you keep rewriting it, you could start to see them more clearly, and how they would react to certain situations more clearly. And so you would rewrite it like that. So it's more of it's certainly a circular process and not a linear process.
All right. So when you plan a book like this, I mean, does that circle include what you think the ending will be? And did that change, for example?
No, for me, never. But a lot of writers outline and they know the ending of the book. A lot of maybe I've heard like mystery writers or, of course, romance writers.
Mm-hmm. Well, whodunit? I guess the writer has
to
know.
Yeah, they have
it,
to
sure.
know. I know Toni Morrison said that she begins each book with a question. And I've always kind of looked at it that way, as a question and not in trying to unravel my characters and what they're desiring.
I'm struck by the things that come up in coffee shop conversations in Out of the Shadows. How much time do you spend in coffee shops listening for interesting tidbits?
Well, I never write in coffee shops because I cannot not listen or
be
present.
I can just imagine the stuff ends up in your text right on the spot. Yeah.
I mean, I've tried it, not to say I would never have, but I have tried it several times, but I'm too... And when I read, I need it silent. When I write, I need it silent. So when I'm in coffee shops, I am more listening than I am doing my work.
Your coffee takes a long time to drink in
yes.
those circumstances. Kimberly
yeah.
Carlson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange from Reading, created her own publishing company, published a book called Out of the Shadows, a novel that came out in 2012. Her main character has some of Kimberly's same concerns about the people of Darfur. We'll be talking about that as we go through the discussion on the Exchange, which you can join. 800-838-3760 is our phone number. Anywhere in the region, you can join us by email as well. jx@jeffnet.org. So the work that Akasha assigns Jamie to do is she actually has to find some philanthropic thing that's not identified by Akasha. Is that right?
It is not. And that's part of the aloofness and mysteriousness that she gives her. And I mean, I don't say this out in the novel, but the belief is that by not giving her a direction, Jamie has to find her own direction. And in finding it, gaining some self-esteem and, finding her own path versus if she just said, I want you to do A, B, and C, then it's Akasha's work. It's not Jamie's work. And so that's why then she starts, she's, like I said, she's at a loss. She's never been an activist. She's never, she's just focused on her own self and her own pain. And so she starts researching, different NGOs and I could read a passage of when she came to discover Darfur.
Please do.
Yes. Okay. So she is with one of the coffee shop workers. She's goes to Fallow Springs is in Sonoma, the wine country. And she goes to San Francisco for a rally. And even at the rally, she feels silly. She's never done something like this before. And she just is walking around kind of like, what am I feeling like she doesn't belong. And one of the women that gets on stage is a woman she recognizes. And then it comes out that she was an exchange student in their home when she was a child. And this woman is actually from Kenya, and Jamie hadn't heard from her in years. And this is when she is listening to her story. The woman is speaking on stage. Jamie says, I made myself listen to her story, the story that she was telling in San Francisco, California, so far from Africa. I wasn't surprised she was back in the States, speaking to a crowd this large. She was a voyager. She was strong and capable, smart, and from a good Kenyan family. Even as a child, I knew life would be hers in the palm of her hand, as they say. I had felt I was average in her presence, colorless, forgettable, but she had never made me feel this way. She would hold me tight before we fell asleep, and she would tell me stories of Africa, of watching the differences of how geese fly. Did you know geese fly differently when going to water than when they are leaving it? Of Kenyan poets, she would recite, "Daughter, take this amulet, tie it with cord and carrying," and of dancing by fire. Her mother would send her during the school holidays to live with her cousins who lived in a village far from Nairobi, to learn the ways of your people, she had been told. Sometimes Inaya and I would dance in my room until we'd fall down, sweaty and exhausted, or until my dad would bang on the door telling me to turn the noise down, that he was watching television. "Listen, Jamie," I told myself as I gazed at her. I took a couple steps back from the stage. Inaya still smiled, but something was gone. Her smile used to make me laugh. It was so big, real, evoking goodness. I'd laugh, and then she would. "Listen," I said to myself. On stage, she cleared her throat and then smiled, a bit unsure. Maybe it wasn't Inaya. I looked at the wounded ankle. A breeze picked up the fabric of her shawl. She wrapped her scarf around her neck. "They took me in, Dafina," she said. I couldn't remember who the announcer said they were. "I was thrown into a hut. I wasn't sure what they did with my friend," Inaya said. Her voice lowered. She came to Darfur because I had asked her to come with me. She shook her head as if a fly landed on her nose. The first man called me a black whore, slave, good for two things, work and rape. I counted the men at first. The first day, 1, 2, 3, 4, until 20. The second day, number 25 came in. I said to him, "You are black, you are African." "I am Arab, Sudan is for Arabs." He used his bayonet. "You are no good, black woman." I stopped counting. Only saw colors surround me. Purple, red, black, the colors of my mother and her birth of me. I wished I had never been born. I desired to be back in my mother's womb and hear the rhythms of her heart, the food she swallowed, the songs she sang, the laughter she released. When the janjaweed moved on, they left me under a tree. It was there I saw Dafina again. Why didn't they leave us in the sun where I would surely have died? Did they want others to see their evilness? Sometimes I think one cared enough, but probably not. Care and kindness can be wiped clean from the spirit of an unnatural man. If we were in Kenya, a lion would find us and eat us. This sounded welcoming, something that made sense. But in Darfur, the lions don't even roam.
Kimberly Carlson reading from her 2012 novel, Out of the Shadows. Kimberly is from Reading and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. The numbers, as I looked them up, just to refresh my own memory about what had happened in Darfur over the years, were staggering. Is it 300,000 dead since 2003?
Yes.
And over what? Just the fact that you're not us?
Right? Yes. They say it's a war against the nomads and the farmers. And also, President al-Bashir will claim that he's simply fighting rebels. But also the president has made clear that he wants Sudan to be an Arab country. And it's been clear, even the United States has, declared this as a genocide. And it's the first genocide being called a genocide while it's being placed. So the Sudanese government pays the nomads, which they call Janjaweed, to come in. And many times first they'll send Antonov bombers and helicopters to drop bombs. And then they'll send the Janjaweed, the evil men on horseback, to come in and rape, pillage. They will poison wells, take all their livestock. And so if the people aren't killed, they certainly are left for dead in this desert with no water.
You know, you point out that this is the first genocide called a genocide while it was in progress, which is a significant thing for humankind, although it doesn't necessarily mean anything gets done.
Correct.
The fact that we're still arguing 100 years later about whether what the Turks did in Armenia was genocide, which is still a huge point of conflict within Turkey. I mean, it's amazing that not only that these things happen, but that people continue to argue about, oh, no, it was. Oh, yes, it was. Mm-hmm. No, it wasn't. That sort of thing. Genocide No More. Save Darfur is a group out of a church in Reading. Is that right?
It's out of a church, but it's not the church. We just use the church's nonprofit. Mm-hmm. number, but it's not affiliated with any religion. We have Muslims in our group and Jews and everybody is welcome. But yes, Genocide No More Save Darfur was founded by Marv Steinberg. I guess about 10 years ago, that's when I met Marv. And since then, the group has done an amazing amount of work. In fact, we have people from Washington claim that our group is one of the most active in the U.S.
It's sort of a combo of names here, Genocide No More, Save Darfur. Is it about other genocides, or is the focus still mostly on Darfur?
We try to keep our focus on Darfur, even though we educate people about genocide in general. Because of what's going on in South Sudan, sometimes those things have bled over just because the conflicts are all related to the regime in Khartoum. And, you know, a few months ago, we at the Cascade Theater, we showed the movie The Good Lie with Reese Witherspoon, and one of the actors, Kuth Will, came to Reading. And that was a tremendous fundraiser and awareness, and we were able to give money to the Enough Project in Washington, D.C., and Sudan Unlimited in San Francisco.
All right, much more to talk about with Kimberly Carlson. Her novel about somebody who cares very much about Darfur, like she does, is Out of the Shadows. We'll come back and talk more about life in that world and in our own world when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking with Kimberly Carlson, the Reading author and publisher. Her 2012 novel is called Out of the Shadows. It's a book about a woman who, like herself, has a great concern for the fate of the refugees in Darfur in Sudan. And Kimberly and Jamie Shire, her character, both have done a lot of work in that respect. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone around the region, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Is it true you've done some work with Amnesty International as well?
Yes, I have. I've gone to Washington, D.C. This is when they were UNAMID, which is part of the United Nations, it's a peacekeeping force in Darfur. They were asking for more helicopters and more funding, and I had gone to Washington D.C. and met with some of our policymakers asking to support UNAMID. And in fact, we're still asking people to support UNAMID. They are the peacekeeping forces still on the ground in Darfur. And so that's what I did with Amnesty.
Jamie, your character in the book, Jamie Shire, ends up at a refugee camp in Chad in the book. Have you been to Africa yourself?
I have not. That's the big question I get asked a lot.
I'm sure.
Like I said, I started this book when I was pregnant.
Right. You've been a little busy, it seems like, with a 9 and a 6-year-old.
I have been offered, by several people, but it's not a safe place, and I'm a mom first, and so I have not. But I will say those chapters that she is in Africa, they were the hardest for me to write, but I am the proudest of those chapters. And I have had people who've been to Chad, the refugee camps, and Darfur read them for accuracy. Halima Bashir, who she wrote Tears of the Desert. She was a victim and now lives in the UK. She read them. And so, no, I someday, but not at this point.
How difficult was it for you at first to understand who was hurting whom in Darfur? It seems like this is one of the big ones to try to communicate to people who don't know much about that part of the world in the first place, probably couldn't find it on a map, and therefore don't even really understand who the people are.
Right. Darfuris are... there's three main tribes, the Furs, the Mosalit, and the Zaghawas. And they are farmers, and they're black Africans, and they are Muslims, like the leaders in Khartoum.
So they are the same religion.
Yes.
All right.
Same religion.
It's the ethnicity that's different. Is it a Sunni versus Shiite split?
It is not. Mm-hmm. It was simply a race issue. And after I've read a lot about the history of Sudan, there used to be lots of slave trade between the Arabs and the blacks as well. So it goes back for centuries.
Now, what's up now? I know there's not much in the news anymore about Darfur. They've managed to pull the warring factions apart. Is that correct?
No, I mean, there's been lots of peace negotiations, and my understanding is that the president easily will sign a peace resolution without any action behind it. I mean, after doing more, my feeling with al-Bashir is he will say what he feels he needs to say at the moment and be on his way. He's been indicted by the ICC, the International Criminal Court, for crimes against humanity and genocide, and yet he still claims innocence. It's just hard to work with someone who basically will lie and say what he needs to say.
Is there less of an issue now with Darfuri people within Sudan itself because many of them have left and are in refugee camps in other countries like in Chad?
No. I mean, I'd recently heard reports that just in 2014 that another 450,000 people have been displaced. And then in October 30th, there was a mass rape in the city of Tabit, which is in northern Darfur. Claims are by the Human Rights Watch that 230 women were raped, and girls and women were raped by Sudanese military officials, and that the government claimed that those accounts that it never happened. And they wouldn't let the UNAMID forces in to even do a report. And when they did let UNAMID in, it was 9 days after. And of course, women are reticent to talk simply because of the culture. Rape is, you know, seen differently.
It's a huge shaming to their victim, correct?
Especially if they become pregnant. Mm-hmm. But people did come in from human rights. So basically, the only reason people aren't hearing about Darfur is because of what's going on in Syria and what's going on in South Sudan between and another area in Sudan that's not getting very much press. I know Nicholas Kristof from the New York Times is the Nuba Mountains. They are mostly using aircraft because they're harder to get in. But they are really worried about famine, and because they're not, and in Darfur, they're not letting any aid people in. So no, Darfur, we're not hearing about it just because there's other things to be talked about. And I think people got tired of it, to be honest, but it's still a huge crisis and it is still being targeted.
Which speaks to a frequent attention span issue with news media and the American public. It's hard to get them. And you're right. I mean, and things that are going on in Syria and Iraq and with ISIS certainly would tend to shove Darfur off the front pages, but there's still an issue there.
Right. Yes. I mean, we keep in our group, it's the whole, there's a one family, his name's Adam Musa, and we've been not tracking him, communicating with him through this organization called IACT, who goes to the refugee camps, but we helped him build a school. He's a teacher in one of the camps, and he recently got fed up with living in a camp and moved his family back to Darfur. And he said he and his 10 children were starving. Our organization raised $1,200 within a few days, and we managed to get some of that money through the border to him, and he actually wrote us back thanking him for keeping his family alive.
So it's not just an issue of getting information out and getting observers in, but also getting any kind of humanitarian aid in. Sounds like an issue too.
Yeah, in 2009, al-Bashir made many of the organizations leave, and the ones that are staying, a lot of times they are being targeted. Some of them are, some of the rebels are, taking their supplies. And then I know in the Nuba Mountains that they have been even bombed a few times. So, we are not hearing about what's going on there.
As a writer, you build relationships in your work between individuals, but when talking about a place like Darfur, you're aware of human interaction on a much broader and substantially more awful scale. But you try to portray that, obviously, through things that have happened to individuals. I mean, were there places where you just were going beyond your own comfort zone just to make sure this got portrayed as well as you could possibly portray it?
Yeah, sometimes when I'm doing a signing or something, and someone will pick up my book and they'll say, "Oh, Africa, Darfur, I don't want to be depressed." I'm like, "Either do I."
Right.
I don't want to be depressed either. But yeah, while writing this book, I had read a lot of personal accounts, and I also, because one of the characters is a Holocaust survivor as well, I read a lot of Holocaust accounts of people harboring Jews, which was just fascinating. And sure, it was so hard. And I, as a writer, you have to be careful of not going too far down into a dark place. But I also feel like somebody has to, and not to be like I'm the person to do it. It is hard, and I do go there, and just the other day I was reading that article by Nicholas Kristof about a mom who takes her 2-year-old and jumps into a foxhole, and she's holding her 2-year-old, this is in the Nuba Mountains, to keep the shrapnel for hitting her, and when it's over, the child's head is blown up. I mean, I didn't want to hear that.
No, and I'm sure Nicholas Kristof doesn't want to see this, but he feels it is necessary. And that's a brave guy. I mean,
people
all over the world, and he's documenting the horrible things that people do to each other on a regular basis.
Yeah. So, and then, with my children, I just, like I said, I thought I would be done when my children were born, but now I feel, a mom living in California. They're relatively safe. I have food. We have medical care. And I feel so blessed. I do. But I don't feel any more worthy than a mom in Africa. I just feel blessed. And so with that blessing, I hope maybe my friend Omar Ismail, who's from El Fasher, Darfur, and he works for the Enough Project in D.C., sometimes I get a little blue and I say, "Why?" And he says, "Kimberly, if you can help one person today, what a job."
That's it. One. We have to start with small expectations. The book itself, Out of the Shadows, has certainly received some acclaim. What is an IPPI Award?
It's from the Independent Publisher Award. The book was independently published. When I went to do it, I wanted a traditional publisher. But at the time, once again, it didn't get picked up for whatever reason. And I heard it's great writing, but, we're not interested in Africa right now. So I started from the ground up and opened up my own company. And I hired lots of people to do all the editing and graphics and all that. But it won. And I went to New York and received an award. It was great.
It was a tie for the best regional fiction for 2013 in the West. Tell us about the process of being, did you know you had won when you went to New York, or was it announced there?
No, I knew I had won. So I did enter. I did wear, it's hard as a writer, even all writers have to wear a marketing hat now, unless you're, the top 1% of 1%. So I often have to look at my work as a marketer and not the writer, which is difficult. And so, I knew I won. And so, it was great.
We do talk to many writers, and some seem happy to crank out 2 to 8 pages a day, like Walter Mosley, who makes it sound like he's quite the machine. But we talk to some others, too, who need to gather up the courage to sit down and get into the lonely space and do what they need to do. Is it something you approach with glee, or oh boy, I'm going to work now. I'm going to shut myself in the room.
No, it's never glee. And that's the part that people are, they just don't get it. But I mean, afterwards you feel so great. And yeah, it's really interesting. I really, for writers who've done it more than 5 years, who've really, really been writing, it's, you know, you can call it a calling, a passion, but I don't know any other way to be now. When I hear things, see things, I see it in story.
One of the Amazon reviews said, I hope Kimberly is working on her next novel, which then brings up the question, what are you working on now?
Yes, it's called, actually I have two projects. One is fiction, self-portrait, and it's about a woman who is a mother and wife, and she desires to live an artistic life too, and women artists haven't been revered historically and even in now. So she begins her life as an artist and a mother, which on some level may seem contradictory. And my that book's just, it's in an editing process, but the one I'm actually writing on that I don't necessarily want to sit down and work on is the, actually my memoir. I wanted to be a country western star as a child, and I moved to Nashville, as we said.
Sure.
And so it talks about the loss of dreams, and I was, you know, being in Reading, I hung out with the Merle Haggard crowd, and so it's gonna head that way.
All right, we'll be looking for that to come out. And I did look for events coming up involving events involving Darfur in Reading. There is an interfaith vigil, prayer vigil for Darfur on Friday, July 31st at 7 at the Sundial Bridge in Reading. Will you be there?
I hope so, yes.
All right. Kimberly Carlson, a pleasure to meet you, and fun to read Out of the Shadows. Not fun necessarily at times, but certainly rewarding. Thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.